2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 252, Paradigm Debates in Mormon Studies, A Brief Guide for the Perplexed, a paper presented by Kevin Christensen, with a response by Christian Anderson.
Purports to be a semi-academic environment. I have 3 degrees from University of Utah. That's not 3 degrees of glory, but it is true that I bleed true red when, as opposed to true blue. Kevin Christensen, as I said, is a longtime friend of mine, and he has published numerous articles, more than I can keep up with. And he recently reintroduced me to Mormon intellectualism a couple of years ago, and he presented a paper on Margaret Barker, and I subsequently read a number of articles and books by Ms. Barker. As a respondent in this case, in this session, Christian Anderson has a B.S. in biology from Stanford University, which he completed last year. For a number of years, he's been highly interested in philosophy and philosophical questions, and has pursued his interest by presenting here at Sunstone a number of times, most recently in 1998, when he presented a paper called Children of the Purge, which was about the excommunications that occurred in 1973 and the resulting effects on the families. I am reminded to exhort any of you who have active cell phones or similar devices to deactivate them as a courtesy to the speakers and the audience. This session is scheduled to continue till for an hour till 3:15, and I'll try to move the speakers along so that they end about by 3:05 or so, so that we can have questions from the audience. With that introduction, I will turn the time over to Kevin Christensen.
It's always wonderful to see so many people willing to admit that they're perplexed. I do that every day when I wake up. Go ahead, let's take a look at this. This is a famous painting by the French Impressionist painter René Magritte. It's a, as you can see, it's an easel in front of a window. And the thing about it is that the easel obscures your view of what is outside the window. For LDS purposes, notice the tree. A lot of questions that we have. Is there a tree outside? How can you know there's a tree outside? Say the tree of life in Lehi's vision. Was that really there? Does that exist? How do we know? And the title of this painting is The Human Condition. There's no way around it. Go ahead to the next one. Well, in the 30s and 40s, there was positivism. It was taken as a, took science as a norm for all meaningful discourse. The positivists have declared the famous verification principle, which states that apart from tautologies and definitions, statements are only meaningful if they can be verified by sense data. Next one. During the 1950s, positivism came under increasing attack, but many of its assumptions were perpetuated in empiricism, which came to replace it as the dominant interpretation of science. Next. The empiricist claims were that science starts from publicly observable data, which can be described in pure observation language, independent of any theoretical assumptions, that theories can be verified or falsified by comparison with this fixed experimental data, and the choice between theories is rational, objective, and in accordance with specifiable criteria. Next. First time I read that, I immediately thought of a bumper sticker that I'd seen. God said it, so you have some publicly observable data. I believe it, you verify or falsify by comparison. That settles it. Rational, objective, and in accordance with specifiable criteria. Well, at Sunstone, I presume that no one is a fundamentalist, that we don't think that way, because we can see that there's some problems with that. And this led up to In the 1960s, Thomas Kuhn published The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which I think is an extraordinary book, and then he did some criticism he received. He did a second edition in 1970. And when I was getting into Kuhn, I also ran across this other book. It's the first book I ever Xeroxed, but I happened to get a copy off the internet later. Ian Barber, Myth, Models, and Paradigms, A Comparative Study of Science and Religion. I've quoted from these books extensively, but I also recommend James Burke had a book called The Day the Universe Changed. There's a PBS series and book in 1985. And for about 15 years, I've been arguing in various places that Alma 32 gives the same epistemology as Kuhn. So let's go to the next one. So what's a paradigm? It's a framework for ordering and interpreting experience. It's defined by standard examples of scientific work that embody a set of conceptual, methodological, and metaphysical assumptions. That's from Kuhn. And Barber goes on to say, as a tradition transmitted through historical exemplars, the concept of the paradigm is thus defined sociologically and historically, and its implications for epistemology, which is the structure and character of knowledge, must be explored. Next. And so what they do is they unify a scientific, or in this case, a religious community, or a group of scholars, or a school of scholars, whatever, around a group-licensed way of seeing, a shared set of standards and rules for scientific practice. Paradigms are extensible, that is, they map the known in satisfying detail, but they are sufficiently open-ended to leave all sorts of problems for the redefined group of practitioners to resolve. And this is very important. They provide the background of expectation against which anomaly appears. You don't have a problem unless you expect something else. So whenever you run into someone saying, here's a problem, that's a clue as to what their expectations are. And the more brittle and rigid the expectations, the more anomalies you can generate. Which is why there aren't many fundamentalists in this room, because that set of expectations is very, very brittle, and it generates lots of anomalies, unless, of course, you decide to suppress them altogether, which I hope we're not going to do. Okay, go ahead. Kuhn compares normal science to puzzle solving. It's like a chess puzzle. You've got the board pieces and the rules in place, and puzzle solving occurs within that paradigm. But paradigm testing is a different kind of thing altogether. It's between rival paradigms, and it concerns which game to play and what rules to use. How do you know when you're in a paradigm debate? Go ahead. Because there's chronic debate over fundamentals. There's disagreement about both problems and solutions. And as Kuhn says, the proponents of competing paradigms are always at least slightly at cross purposes. Neither side will grant all the non-empirical assumptions that the other needs in order to make its case. The competition between paradigms is not the sort of battle that can be resolved through proofs. Go ahead. See, we don't just see, we see as. When I was in 7th grade, my English teacher, Miss Summerall, passed this picture out to the class. And she asked us all to take a look at it, and then she said, how many in here would like to go on a date with that girl? And I was sitting next to a handsome guy, Jim Jensen. He raised his hand, and I thought, what is he looking at? What an idiot. What is he trying to pull? But the problem is, you see, the artist has created ambiguities in there. Is that a mouth or a necklace? Is that a chin or a nose? Is that an eye or an ear? It's irresolved. You can see it one way or the other, but not both ways at once. If you can shift back and forth, that's a good thing. But if you're insisting there's only one way to see it, that's ideological. That's not logical. Okay, let's go to the next one. In LDS circles, paradigms define problem fields, and I won't read all of those. They define methods for testing, and they define standards of solution. Go ahead to the next one. Now, with positivism, the verification had seemed a clear-cut and straightforward process. It was assumed that theories are verified by their agreement with experimental data. Knowledge, it was said, consists of proven propositions established by hard facts. Next. The problem. No scientific theory of great generality can be verified. One cannot prove that a theory is true by showing that conclusions deduced from it agree with experiments, since future experiments may conflict with theory, and two, another theory may be equally compatible with present evidence. From a finite set of particular observations, one cannot derive a universal generalization with certainty. Go ahead. So here's a standard solution for verification. Despite the popular, this is from Mr. Vogel over here and Brent Metcalf. Despite the popularity of their theories, Book of Mormon geographers have been unable to deliver a single archaeological dig that can be verified by reputable Mesoamericanists as the ruins of an ancient Near Eastern culture, much less of Lehites and Jaredites. And I think that's an immensely interesting statement. And one question that I would have is, why would you look for the ruins of an ancient Near Eastern culture in Mesoamerica? They tend to be found in the ancient Near East. So what you're looking for and who is looking is going to make a difference. Go ahead to the next one. Here's a rival method, problem field, and standard of solution. This is from Brant Garner. This is going to be published at press. I have an article that quotes similar links on this. He was looking at the same problem that Mr. Vogel and Mr. Metcalf were talking about. As a Mesoamericanist, he said for years, I just felt like he could, cry over it or laugh or cry, but couldn't resolve it. And he says, the difference came to get a different paradigm. And I love this quote because it's a classic paradigm shift. The difference came when I started looking for Mesoamerica in the Book of Mormon instead of the Book of Mormon in Mesoamerica. Oddly enough, there is a huge difference, and the nature of the correlations and the quality of the correlations has changed with that single change in perspective. And from his perspective, he says the entire text of the Book of Mormon works better in a Mesoamerican context. So he's not looking for an ancient Near Eastern culture. He's looking for Mesoamerica. It's a very different game, a different paradigm. This is something I want to get across, is it's an entirely different way of looking at things. And he says, what he likes about his, he says it's a single interpretive framework that is in the right place at the right time. Okay, go ahead. And this gets to the issue of seeing and being. A couple of Greeks, a long time ago, had a big argument about appearance. And they said, if appearance is all we have to go by anyway, we can never say that a thing is so, but only that it seems so. And this is the thing of claiming to manage the measure of all things, whatever seems is. And it's a pretty good argument, but the problem is it keeps on breaking down over and over again. There's a great quote by Whithead on this, where he talked about how he'd been taught in all the fundamentals of geography, geology, mathematics, chemistry, cosmology, and when he went through school, and he says in his lifetime, the fundamental assumptions about all of them were radically transformed in his own lifetime. Seeming is the current map, but reality is the territory, and further exploration always, always changes the map. A closer look at everything changes everything. I remember watching JPL Labs, when they had the flyby of the Jupiter moons. And you get these amazing pictures of the four major moons, and the guys at JPL are saying, there goes another three. They get close to the next moon, blow everything that they thought away. Just a closer look at everything. Just count on it. It's going to change things. Go ahead. And here's the thing that people, I think that Coon's critics are most upset with this. The science runs on faith. He says, the man who embraces a new paradigm at an early stage must often do so in defiance of the evidence provided by problem solving. He must, that is, have faith that the new paradigm will succeed with the many large problems that confront it, knowing only that the older paradigm has failed in a few. A decision of that kind can only be made on faith. And when people are insisting that they're purely rational, purely logical, they don't want to hear that. So it's interesting to read some of the critiques that are passionate in their denunciation. And they're giving themselves away because there's so much passion and how much they hate this idea. Go ahead. And now there's this business of self-reference. This is one of the interesting things about paradigms. They differ in more than substance, for they are also directed not only to nature, but back upon the science that produced them. They are the source of the methods, problem field, and standards of solution accepted by any mature scientific community at any time. And when paradigms enter, as they must, into a debate about paradigm choice, the role is necessarily circular. Each group uses its own paradigm in that paradigm's defense. Go to the next one. This is a quote from Mr. Vogel on a paper online where he tells me that I'm wrong about everything. And he says, it would be pointless for me to refer to Joseph Smith if I did not also believe his views were consistent with the Book of Mormon, that is, authorship. They were consistent because he wrote the book. I refer to the statements of Smith and of other first readers to bring perspective and context to the text. Well, this is, you can see the closed loop here. I've seen it elsewhere. I just use Mr. Vogel not to pick on him so much, but because it's a very tight loop. There's an argument in BYU Studies called Naturalistic Assumptions in the Book of Mormon. Did the same thing at greater length. Okay, but see, both sides do this. Go to the next. That's self-reference in action. That's famous Escher thing. You kind of make the rules to make the picture, but, you know, the chicken and egg thing, there's no getting around it. Go to the next one. All data is theory-laden. There is no plain meaning of the text, no straightforward reading, no pure observation in which contexts can and do change meaning. That means that theory is revisable in light of observation, but sometimes you have to change your observations in light of theory. Go ahead. So you get to this problem. You can't verify things. Can you falsify them? This is what Karl Popper was trying to bring in the verification book down. Go ahead. And here's another claim. Before questioning my methodology, Christensen could keep in mind that no matter how many correlations one perceives in the text, one negative evidence cancels them all. In other words, it is the apologists who are obliged to answer every negative evidence, while those who doubt only need present evidence for rejecting the Book of Mormon. Okay, go ahead. The problem with falsification is that every problem that normal science sees as a puzzle can be seen from another viewpoint as a counterinstance and thus a source of crisis. And since no paradigm ever solves all the problems it defines and no two paradigms leave all the same problems unsolved, paradigm debates always involve the question, which problems are more significant to have solved? I learned when I was a kid on the playground that if you got in an argument with somebody, you know, my dad's bigger than your dad or whatever, or this team is better, so what is always a good answer. What that says is, I do not value your argument. I'm not going to consider it. I'm not going to bother with it. In John Charles's essay in The Sunstone, it's a part of The Start where he describes a strategy by people to just say, if you decide that the anti-Mormons are the enemy and not there, you don't have to confront their arguments. And then later in the same essay, he says the same thing about himself with regard to farms. He says he just, you know, doesn't bother dealing with them because he has an a priori rejection of the paradigm. But this is the way it works for everybody. Okay, go ahead. The empiricists, this is Ian Barber, the empiricists have claimed that even though a theory cannot be verified by its agreement with data, it can be falsified by disagreement with data. But critics show that discordant data alone have seldom been taken to falsify an accepted theory in the absence of an acceptable alternative. Instead, auxiliary assumptions have been modified, or the discrepancies have been set aside as anomalies. You just decide, well, I haven't solved that puzzle. Go ahead. So, and I already talked about this a little bit. So, you got anomalies. Every paradigm has some. How do you decide which ones are important? And which ones can you put on the shelf and wait? Which ones deserve a back burner treatment? Which ones deserve your intense concentration? Which ones are going to break your paradigm? Well, there can be issues for fundamental generalizations. That's things like hemispheric geography exclusive ancestry for the Native American inhabitants. Those are fundamental generalizations. Specific practical applications. That can be things like, well, how did Joseph Smith, how literal is the translation? How much input did Joseph Smith have? How can you tell by, say, comparing to the New Testament manuscripts that we have or something? Or research puzzles that currently resist solution. This was the B.H. Roberts study in 1923. He had some puzzles that he could not solve. And he went to his authority figures in 1923 and he said, I don't have answers to these things. Do you guys? And they said, the answer was no. Well, it turns out, go to the next one, that this perspective thing, how do you decide what's important? In these winning anomalies. This is from a book by Betty Edwards, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. is an example of how a capacity for perceptual error is built into our perception. That, don't kid ourselves that there's no way. If you went up there and you took a little caliper and you measured that tree in the background with the two trees up here in the front, they take up exactly the same vertical height on the physical page. But even if you know that, it doesn't matter. You're going to see it as larger. And there's a couple of great quotes. Go to the next one. This is from the book. Most of us tend to see parts of the form hierarchically. The parts that are important, that is, this is, I italicized this and she didn't, that is, they provide a lot of information. Or the parts that we decide are larger, or the parts we think should be larger, we see as larger than they are. And the converse is true. And this works both with our feeling and with our thinking. Both sides of the brain can contribute to the perceptual error. Go ahead. And at the very top level, for noticing value, you can ask the question, is something ideal? Is it what I want, what I desire? Regardless of what I should want, given what my desires might cost. You can say, is it perfect? Is it flawless? Does it fit with what I think it should be? Is it orthodox? Is it what I should fear? Am I capable of judging these things? Or a third question, is it real? And I would submit that this is key. These are three very, very different things, very different questions. And what becomes important, what conveys a lot of information, changes as you move from ideal to perfect to real. Go to the next one. You have an entirely different method, problem field, and standard of solution. For example, when the question is perfection, imperfection conveys a lot of information. Nothing that fits can be decisive, but imperfection by itself is decisive, so it becomes big in your head. Same thing with one's ideal or desire. Frustration, then, conveys a lot of information. I had a friend in England who said, she said about the church, if it's the truth, why isn't there more truth in it? I'm just going to get a glass of water. Okay. And I thought it was a wonderful question at the time, but I thought about it a lot, and I realized what she was saying. She's talking about this thing about perfect and ideal. How come it's not perfect? How come I have these things that look wrong? How come I have this frustration? And then she made a decision. She said, I decided I'm going to do what I want to do without anybody telling me. What I didn't understand at the time is that kind of decision not only changes what you do, but it changes how you experience life. Go ahead. Now this, if you look in comparative mythology, there's this wonderful passage in Power of the Myth where Joseph Campbell is talking about Buddhist shrines. So if you go to a Buddhist shrine, there's these two guardians. One has his mouth open, one closed. He says they're not demons. We'd see them as demons, but in the Buddhist mythology, they represent fear and desire. They are the guardians of the real. If you want to get to the real, you have to go past these. You have to take what you think and what you want and at least be willing to risk it. That is, you offer the sacrifice of a broken heart, what you want, and a contrite spirit. You're willing to give up things that you think. And if you're not willing to do that, if you can't give your heart and your mind, if you can't be willing to at least give up your desires and fears, you're never going to get to the real. You have set up stakes and bounds. As Joseph Smith said, that's what the critique of creeds is in Mormon thought, is that, and I think the genius of Joseph Smith in saying, having an open-ended thing, that you're always willing to learn more. Go ahead. So here we have this crisis resolution. I kind of left this with B.H. Roberts' thing. Well, you can have things like, normal science handles the crisis. Hugh Nibley did a paper a long time ago called Howlers in the Book of Mormon, where he was highlighting reversals of falsifications. More recently, Matt Roper did another one where he called it boomerang hits in the Book of Mormon, where something that just seems wrong, something else comes up and everything falls into place. And this is exactly why I'm so excited about Margaret Barker's work, is when I just had, you know, a new paradigm and all of these former falsifications all of a sudden were verifications.
Another thing you can do, and this is exactly what the Brethren did with B.H. Roberts in 1923, the problem is labeled and set aside for a future generation. And in my opinion, that was the correct answer, because the information was not available to anybody. You have to wait, if you were patient enough, to wait till 1985, then Jack Welch puts out his paper answering B.H. Roberts' questions. And then this final thing, a new paradigm emerges with the ensuing battle for acceptance. And then you have this different framework. And these can happen at different levels. And one of these things that gets argued about a lot now is Sorensen's hypothesis. Go ahead. Now, paradigms resist falsification because a network of theories and observations is always tested together. Any particular hypothesis can be maintained by rejecting or adjusting other auxiliary hypotheses. And just a second here. The important thing is whether when Copernicus first suggested, say, the heliocentric theory, he had circular orbits, and it wasn't as accurate as the Ptolemaic theory. They had all of these complex things going on. It initially wasn't as accurate. Then Kepler comes along and he makes some adjustments, but his adjustments were based on these, they led to the laws of motion. These things were generally applicable. So the question is when you're making an adjustment, is it something that's based on a general principle, or are you just trying to cover up some bonehead thing that doesn't fit? And that's the question, and there's going to be doubt in, but it's something to assess those. Go ahead. Sample assumptions in approaching the Book of Mormon. I won't go through all of these, but you can see there's a whole network of assumptions. The one at the very top, the existence of God, is probably the most important. And things are going to fan out under that, and there'll be different levels of interconnection and how one change might affect other things. But there is this whole network of assumptions that deserve examination. Go ahead. Here's an example assumption I like, and I hear a lot. Surely a prophet would know. That can be explicit or implicit, but I notice the contrast with D&C 25:26. And as much as they erred, it might be made known, and as much as they sought wisdom, they might be instructed. Have this matter of fact, they don't know everything. So if I make a mistake, and like it, I don't say, surely a prophet would know. I say, well, why not? Okay, go ahead to the next one. Here's another thing I call arbitrary unfulfilled conditions. A good example of this is when the news comes to Jesus that Lazarus has died, and some people are listening and they're watching Jesus weep, and some of them, could not this man Jesus, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that this man Lazarus should not have died? It's an example that sometimes you can never do enough. It can never be good enough. Here's Jesus doing the miracles. That's not enough. They're asking, well, he could have prevented this guy from dying. Go ahead. So, getting down to a realistic appraisal here. Theories are neither verified nor falsified, but assessed by a variety of criteria. It makes a great deal of sense to ask which of two actual and competing theories fits the facts better. That can be which religion fits your experience better. Paradigm choice is a value-based tentative decision, that is, its faith. It's not a rule-based final decision, that is, it's not perfect knowledge. Now, Alma 32 makes a distinction between cause to believe and perfect knowledge, and I think it's very important that I can testify of all sorts of things that to me are cause to believe, but they do not give me perfect knowledge. But for a person who's willing to walk by faith, cause to believe is enough. I have a lot. Keep going. This is Ian Barber's thing that I like a lot. This is critical realism. He says, you have to accept that theory influences observation with the result that all data are to some degree theory-laden. Although proponents of rival theories inevitably talk through each other to a degree, he says adherents of rival theories can seek a common core of overlap to which both can retreat. Recognize that comprehensive theories are indeed resistant to falsification, but observation does exert some control over theory, and accumulation of anomalies cannot be ignored indefinitely. You may do it for a while, you may work on the puzzle for a while, but these things do create pressure. Like, think of that, a metaphor, I think of like a center of gravity. There's this pull by certain things. And then finally, the last thing, there's no rules for choice between paradigms, but there are criteria of assessment independent of particular paradigms. And that's important. Barbara points out that it's that that preserves the objectivity of science. Not that science is objective, but because there are some things that aren't paradigm dependent, that aren't that self-referential thing. And I'll be talking about what these criteria of assessment are. Go ahead. Accuracy of key predictions. And what makes a prediction key? Part of that is inevitably, what door do you want to open? Comprehensiveness and coherence. By that, we're talking about how much does it explain? How does it tie everything together? How internally consistent is it? The fruitfulness of it. You just try it on for size. You know, Jesus saying, if you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. You just try it on for size, and if you start seeing things that you never would have seen otherwise, that's this fruitfulness. Simplicity and aesthetics. Like E equals MC squared is, you know, there's a certain amount of aesthetic power just to how he can say that in a single equation. Then finally, the future promise thing. One of the reasons that Kepler and Copernicus were rejecting the old theory is the other one was just getting too darn ugly. It was just getting so kludgy and complex to maintain. Even though it was accurate, they thought that something else has to be out there. So, go ahead. Now, there's not just constraining things for paradigm choice. There are also randomizing values, these fear and desire thing. And this, John Charles quoted this first passage here. He didn't, I think, give as much attention to the constraints, but autobiography, personality, nationality, or prior reputation of innovator, that is, authority. Teachers, well, this is important. What's your personal first and great commandment? What is your altar upon which competing considerations must be sacrificed? And then I've talked about in Human Farm articles, selectivity, subjectivity, context, changes in knowledge over time. Those things kind of randomize value, but we do have the constraints, and they're working together. There's a constant opposition, but you can always work to emphasize the constraining things. Go ahead. One thing that can be done when you're trying to talk across paradigms is to try and find some common ground. Like instead of starting a discussion about things, you know, what do we disagree on, which immediately sets up boundaries. If you start from the things that you all have in common, it's easier to communicate. And Ian Barber comes up with these things. He talks about order and creativity in the world, these common mythic symbols and patterns that underlie most religious traditions, key historical events that define separate traditions and bind individuals, numinous awe and reverence, mystical union, moral obligation, reorientation and reconciliation, which you notice are thinking and feeling. You change how you think about something, you change how you feel about it. That's the conversion experience. And in religion, it's with respect to personal sin, to guilt, to weakness, to the existence of evil, suffering, and death, tensions between science and faith. Those things you need to have your thinking and feeling adjusted at times. Martin Buber talks about this personal dialogue as a thing where you can begin to interpret external events as God speaking to you and answer through your own actions. He called it the I am thou. I always think of Tevye talking to God in the Fiddler on the Roof. Plus, there's this social and natural behavior. All of these things are the wine of religious experience. And you notice if you're looking at it this way, go to the next one, that this is the cause to believe. I mean, at the core of anyone in any religious tradition anywhere, everybody has some of this. And they're what give cause to believe. And it's not an all-or-nothing approach. You've got multiple strands of which key historical events are but one thread and one bundle. So it's the thing with Mormonism is that we experience all of those things. So we shouldn't approach our texts or our prophets or anything else with an all-or-nothing feeling like that we're standing at the edge of the abyss. The question is, you know, which is better? Okay, go ahead. What's at stake? Every community celebrates and reenacts particular historical events which are crucial to its corporate identity and its vision of reality. And Bushman gives the specific Mormon take on this. What distinguished Mormonism was not so much the Gospel Mormons taught, which in many respects resembled other Christians' teachings, what they believed had happened to Joseph Smith, to Book of Mormon characters, to Moses and Enoch. The core of Mormonism is history, not philosophy.
Go ahead.
For example, we'll skip down. I'll talk about that. I've got enough time for that. Go ahead. Next one. Another quote from Barber. He says, participation in the religious tradition also demands a more total personal involvement that occurs in science. Religious questions are of ultimate concern, since the meaning of one's existence is at stake. Religion asks about the final objects of a person's devotion and loyalty, for which he will sacrifice other interests if necessary. Too detached an attitude may cut off a person from the very kinds of experience which are religiously most significant. Reorientation and reconciliation are transformation of life patterns affecting all aspects of personality, not intellect alone. Religious writings use the language of actors, not the language of spectators. Religious commitment, then, is a personal response, a serious decision implicating one's whole life, a willingness to act and suffer for what one believes in. And here we go to the final slide. Go ahead. I'll skip down. Let's go to the final slide. So here we are. Faith or doubt. We can have people saying something as a counter instance, but I notice that that always depends on paradigm assumptions, and it's always subject to potential reversals in light of new knowledge. You can evaluate the same thing as a puzzle and say, Lord, I believe, help down my unbelief. Kuhn calls this recognition of unsolved problems the essential tension in science. He says that working scientists cannot function unless they are willing to deal with things that are unsolved. Otherwise, there's nothing for them to do, because what they're trying to do, whether in scholarship or science or in our personal lives, trying to work out things that we don't have the answers to. But if we think of it as a puzzle, something that can be worked out, that does have a solution, then we can give it the time and the effort to get to those things. And again, this is what I recognize from Alma, this cause to believe that we can get. It's not a perfect knowledge, but it doesn't have to be. I guess I'll just give a brief testimony myself. The first time, probably the only time in my life I ever got rattled with respect to my faith was when there was an article in Dialogue about the different creation accounts. And, you know, for about 3 days I was just puzzling over certain things, and then on the third day I had this, I made a connection in my head, and it was like, you know, like, oh, the lights came on. I saw this thing, and I cranked out an essay that was eventually published in Dialogue. And when they accepted it, it had been so long that I forgot that I'd written it. But in the meantime, I look at the things that I know that have been important to me that I've written, and that I feel like if I had stumbled, if I had missed at that point, the things that I've experienced and learned since then, I would have missed, and I wouldn't have even known what I was missing. You know, the experience I had of, you know, find a book on a shelf. You see a title, The Great Angel by Margaret Barker in Dallas, a store I've never been in, the only Margaret Barker book I've ever seen on a bookshelf in this country. Pull it off the shelf. 2 years later, I'm sitting in an audience at BYU watching thousands of people listening to her talk. Because of that one act, that the things, these small things, great things can come out from. And thank you for coming and for putting up with my perplexity on these things. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much to Sunstone for and to all of you for coming to hear this, and for Kevin Christensen for providing such a sophisticated framework for a problem that's always seemed pretty intractable to me, of epistemology, of knowing what we know. One of the most disturbing things about being religious in the world, I think, is especially recently, is the image of the planes going into the buildings in September 11th. You know, we are all believers in something that very few other people believe. And are we on the plane, or are we the terrorists that are flying it? It's a very difficult problem, and I'm not sure that there is any real way of ever knowing the answer to that. And I thank Kevin for providing such a coherent and such a coherent attempt at getting at that question. I think it's only appropriate, given this paradigm debate, that I begin by speaking of my own paradigm. As Mr. Peterson told you, I just graduated from school with a degree in biology. I spent a great deal of time studying statistics and computer science, which are tools that scientists use for verification. I spent almost all my resources and all my time in this pursuit, which suggests I did, in fact, believe it had some value. The reasons I believe this are somewhat less clear than they were at the start of this paper, but it's too late to go back, so I'll just have to deal with what we have. I also ask for Kevin's forgiveness, since I'm going to begin by doing the most painful thing you can do to a philosopher, which is summarize his argument. I apologize in advance that I'm oversimplifying, but I feel we've covered such a long distance, it's useful to at least glance at the roadmap to see where we've come before I try and go any further. So first, Christensen said, and when I say Christensen says, I mean Christensen selectively quotes from Kuhn or Barber to make this point. Humans can never reason with complete objectivity, but rather have to evaluate the truth of different things based on their own perceptions, their paradigm. Thus, absolute truth is never truly knowable, and since our knowledge is colored by the imperfections of our perceptions and their reasoning, and therefore scientific fact, as the empiricist claims to the contrary, is really just a form of faith. Socrates, I think, must sum this up by saying, the only thing I know is I don't know. Christensen proposes we can go a little bit farther than that. We can also not know other things. We are thwarted in our attempts to verify, but we can at least falsify. So, assuming that there is an external reality, paradigms that are not true eventually break down. Reality will cast a shadow of an anomaly on your paradigm at the point where it is no longer holds. And the better your paradigm, the longer you can go before this happens, and the more obvious it is when it happens. So this leaves us with an unending process of elimination, where we sort of propose all the possible conceivable paradigms and eliminate the ones that have anomalies pop up in them. This is, of course, an unending process, but at least it's a process. We can go somewhere with it. So although we cannot know truth, we can know untruth, and thus purify smaller and smaller subsets of things that are not wrong. Christensen here throws a wrench in the whole works by pointing out that the paradigms that are worth considering are not just right or wrong. They explain A, B, and C, but not D, or they explain A, B, and D, but not C. And accepting one or the other depends mostly on whether you value C or D more, but which one you care about. Through Barber, Christensen proposes that there is some universal criteria you can use to say whether C or D is more valuable. That's what saves, as he said extemporaneously, that's what saves scientific objectivity. There's some way of telling which one was more important. And they are accuracy, comprehensiveness, fruitfulness, aesthetics, and future promise. So if we are able to overcome our fear and desire, and make a rational decision based on only those five criteria, then we get the right paradigm, and we come closer to ultimate truth. And this acceptance of a paradigm is a very serious problem, because once you have it, you will try hard not to break it. If an anomaly occurs, you'll try and say, that's not an anomaly, really, that's just something I haven't figured out yet. The paradigm's still good, it just needs a little tweaking along the way. And Christensen concludes with an admirable caution to seek common ground in conflicting paradigms and to only accept a paradigm when you have it tentatively. So I hope I understand that argument reasonably correctly, and I find it profound and accurate, which are two characteristics that rarely go together, so this is good. I have one serious comment and one quibble with it. Being 24, I choose to quibble. At college, I met many people who believe that human beings are essentially large molecular chemical machines, and that all human thought is explainable by interactions of biomolecules in the brain, and there is no soul, there's just a lot of relativistic interactions of quantum particles. I know someone else who confronted with this, with exactly the same data, both brilliant men, choose to say that this proves that there is a God, that some intelligent being created all of these things. And the choice is not based rationally, the choice is based on what they choose to value. One person values awe and mystery and unexplainability and faith. One person values being able to explain everything by the tool of biology. Other examples abound, I'm sure. What I'm trying to say is this. Your values come from your paradigm. And although many of the parameters will remain the same when you are choosing between paradigms, and I think everyone should consider aesthetics and the other four, the values that you set on each of those five conditions will depend on which paradigm you are coming at it from. So I now shift to my serious extension of this theory, which I hope is useful. All of this talk has basically been about how you choose your paradigm, what paradigm you want to be in, you want to see the world through. I wonder why we want to choose one at all. It seems to me that a paradigm was originally invented to describe the necessary evil of our flawed perceptions, and that a paradigm is an unconscious noise you add to reality, an unconscious filter that you put onto reality, because you're unaware other ones exist. You have other filters. Now, if we have many paradigms, and we are aware of the many paradigms, then I don't think it's valid to choose between them. I think it's valid to, as in the optical illusion, see both the old woman and the young woman and be able to snap from one to the other. Being able to see more than one Weltanschauung means there's more Anschauung in your personal Welt. I further feel that this position is encouraged in the temple ceremony, which tells us all truth is circumscribed into one coherent whole. And I don't think that in this specific instance you need to accept flat-out empiricist views of the Book of Mormon, or fundamentalist or faithful views of the Book of Mormon, or some bastard child of the two, but that you can go between the two, that your scientific view informs your religious view informs your scientific view, and you would be in some ways crippled without the two. Great, but let's get back to the real question. So does the Book of Mormon describe literal realities? According to one view, no. According to another view, yes. According to another view, there's no way of judging. The reality that matters is not addressed by science. Paradigms don't need to conflict, though, on this way. We could look at it, at the Book of Mormon, through a historical paradigm, a literal, a symbolic, an esoteric, a neurobiological, a psychoanalytical, as many people are doing, even as we speak in this building. All may provide different information, but not all of it needs to be contradictory. The key is to be able to recognize which paradigm you are using right now, which paradigm you want will answer the question you have, and snap into it when necessary. So although I don't want to speak for anyone else, This brings me back to my own personal paradigm. I attend Sunstone because I want to know all the paradigms out there. I believe that there is a core truth above and beyond the tangible world. I believe in a supernature, and I believe that this supernature is only knowable when looked at from more than one perspective. A God who creates a million different points of view will only be properly viewed from all 1 million points. Like Christensen, I close by encouraging all of us not to take an all-or-nothing approach to how we view the church and the truth, but rather to take nothing but all approaches to the truth. By my count, we can still expose ourselves to 7 more of them this weekend, and I can hardly wait for the next. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kevin and Christian, and we ended just on time. We have about 10 minutes for questions and answers. I understand they're attempting to record these sessions. So if you could come up here and ask your question for the recorder. And
one thing is very clear from the session, I should have gone to hear Paul Swenson. I'm not sure I understood anything of what went on today, so let me ask, I believe the Book of Mormon is true based on its internal consistency. But when I come to things like the major battles, I wonder why someone hasn't found all those piles of bones. I have bad moments. In 25 words or less. How does what you just said help me solve that problem?
Well, it's that you solved your own problem already. Yes, you did, because you said that the thing that gives you a testimony of the Book of Mormon is its internal consistency. For you, that is the key problem to have solved. And the other questions that give you bad moments, you can treat as a puzzle. You can put it on a back burner and say, well, I don't have the answer to this. And that's fine, you don't. I mean, it's a better answer than pretending that you do. And that's why Alma talks about cause to believe, and he contrasts that with people who want to know. And he says that the implication of those verses is that the ones who just say have cause to believe are better off because they're open-ended. They can change, they can adapt, they can be surprised and not lose everything. Whereas the ones who are rigid and think they have the answer can shatter. A long time ago in English class, I came up with the image of, I said, it was as though a crystal tornado had coughed. And if you're so brittle that something can do that to you, some people can be shattered. But if you recognize that there is something real there, you know, and that's there's a beautiful question in Alma 32 where he goes through and he talks about this growing testimony. And he says, is this not real? You know, and then he goes on and says, but is your knowledge perfect? But the answer to that question is no. Even though you've got this testimony, even though you've learned these things, you've experienced some of this stuff, he says, your knowledge isn't perfect yet. And that's a good thing. That just means that there may be something more else interesting out there. So I think that that you're in good shape.
That was more than 25 words. I mean, gentlemen, I'm sorry.
I think Kevin just explained to us in a rather long version Pascal's wager, which is that since you don't know, you believe. As a non-believing yet practicing LDS, I still can't grapple around the concept that the cumulative amount of information is so big and so massy. I've just gotten to the point where I've stopped trying to explain it all, and I still can't understand why people would have faith in that mass.
In 25 words or less,
Another friend of mine once said to me, how can you know what you know and believe what you believe? An exceedingly good question. My answer to him is, maybe you know some things that you don't. It's this thing with there are answers that I do have. You know, to say that I don't know everything isn't to say that I don't know anything. And that's why I keep writing. You know, all of the articles that I've written, you know, whether it's been for Dialogue or Farms or Sunstone or Fair, it's usually just been something that has just, I've had an open question myself, and I've got a back burner while these things simmer, and then I run across something, and I just get excited, and I'm Archimedes up out of the bath running naked down the street. I'm like, Eureka, this is it, I found it, and I want to share it. That doesn't mean I've solved all the problems, but it means I'm on a track of something real that's not going to go away. When I was a kid, my dad and mom took me out to the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry. And there was no road, it was just gullies and dirt and things. And I must have been 4 or 5 years old. This is one of my earliest memories. We went out there, there was no buildings, there was just a couple of guys in jeans and hats and sunglasses working with dental tools and toothbrushes to uncover these bones. Well, I saw the bones. They're a real phenomenon that's not going to go away. It gets more and more complex every year. But the first books that I read about those things, everything has changed in my lifetime. But that doesn't mean it's not real. So that's the different question. Is it real? And I think my faith is that I'm holding on to something real. Not that I'm making a leap in a blindness. I'm hoping I'm going to get solutions to other questions. But I've touched things that to me, in my existence, my life, are real. Mr. Vogel, come up and sit me down.
Just real quick, I noticed that you have an uncritical acceptance of Kuhn's idea among most of the philosophers of science nowadays. A lot of his ideas are highly questionable. Kuhn had his own paradigm that he couldn't see out of either, and most historians regard his history of the revolution, scientific revolutions, as being reductionistic. He tries to push every scientific discovery into this paradigm that he has, and philosophers of science, Kuhn actually, most people might not know that Kuhn is the father of modern relativism, and the self-referential thing applies to Kuhn as well. So what the relativists are saying is that all truth out there is relative except ours. And what came out of Kuhn was postmodernism, which is finally some good books have been written about postmodernism to criticize it. But the postmodernists try to say that all truth is culturally relative, and there's no absolute truth, which makes me wonder, how can someone who believes in absolute religious truth use postmodernism in Kuhn? Plus, another related issue is that most of the people that are attracted to this type of approach, and Kevin's not the only one, there's lots of various religious pseudoscientist groups out there that use Kuhn and postmodernism, but the one thing that theme that runs through them all is that they always find themselves on the short end of the evidence. So I would like to Christensen to tell us how he resolves the idea of relative truth, so that the truth is only socially constructed, the position of the constructionist, and how that helps save your faith somehow. It seems like you're losing more, you're curing the patient to cure the disease.
Yeah, with time fast going, I'm going to intervene. I was going to raise the same kind of question, that is, the application of paradigm, which was applied to science, almost implies that for us to be genuinely seeking and finding truth, we're little scientists.
And that raises all kinds of difficulties. If we got deeply into Kuhn, we couldn't adopt the kind of thing that Christian is advocating, that is, looking at many paradigms simultaneously, essentially, because the very training of a scientist brings us into a single paradigm, and we have such difficulty breaking away from that that it takes a revolutionary to break away from that. And so I get very uncomfortable about the use of paradigm for getting at the thing these folks are talking about. I would much prefer talking about ideal types from Max Weber, for example, or Foucault, postmodernist, and his epistema. And those kinds of things are, to me, right on target for what Christian is getting at, because I like to look at the world or reality or religion from as many perspectives as I can, but Kuhn is not the appropriate tool to do that as far as I'm concerned.
Kevin. I'll just finish. Notice that I brought two books, Ian Barber and Kuhn. I think Barber takes things a bit further than Kuhn. That's why I use them. I quote them all the time.
Okay. I have time for one more question.
Well, I was going to talk about epistemology of David Lewis and proper ignoring, but if you think Mr. Vogel said, are just wrong. Postmodernism didn't come out of Kuhn. Postmodernism goes back several decades before. It's usually it's a term meaning after modernity. It's a broad dating of several different philosophies. It tries to attack these major assumptions of modernism, the rational subject, the idea of progressing towards the sum of bone reality through science and rationalism. So that's just a mistake. Also, Kuhn's work has been radically misinterpreted by a lot of people. It's no real thoroughly time to talk about it, but I think it is worth saying that Mormons don't believe in absolute truth. If by absolute you mean the ontotheological definition of absolute, there are many other conceptions possible. The only place I ever see the word absolute truth used is in a talk by Spencer Kimball, but yeah, it's widely circulated through correlated materials in Sunday schools, but doesn't mean really much anything, is that there is some sort of moral reliable standard in the teachings and personality of Christ, the jettison of all the metaphysical assumptions that are embedded in the Western tradition of the last 2,000 years. But with David Lewis, a philosopher at Princeton, died very recently, he talked about how epistemology pursued forthrightly leads to the destruction of all beliefs. You can always look at possibilities. Do you know that you know, lock your door, or do you know your house is not on fire? Well, until I consider the possibility in a modal sense, I was sure that now I see it, think of it as a possible objection. Maybe I'm not so sure. He wrecks a theory of proper ignoring. And I think if you have place, like Christensen said, about a certain value based on aesthetic sensibility, you can properly ignore certain types of inconsistencies in a paradigm. I think most of us have our religious beliefs based on religious practices, which are more, I think, fundamental than religious paradigms.
Well, thank you, Christian Anderson, Kevin Christensen. Thank those of you who participated, and thank all of you for being here.